All right. I don't remember if we said this at the time, and I want to revisit it for a second. And that is when Rachel says to Jacob, "You need to plead to God on my behalf, or I don't have a child and it's your fault." And Jacob says, "Am I in the place of God?" One of the commentators points out that if you look back at chapter 25, verse 21, and I don't remember if I called attention to this before, but it's worth calling attention to before we get to today's subject. But chapter 25, verse 21 in Genesis, you see the following. Isaac pleaded with God on behalf of his wife, for she was childless. And God acceded to his entreaty, in other words, agreed to his plea, so his wife Rebekah became pregnant. Okay, so what Rachel is saying is, if I recall properly, your father pleaded to God and your mother got pregnant with you, so it's your fault. If you pleaded, just God would answer your prayer just as your father's prayer was answered. And that sets the stage for additional conflicts, and now we're going to move to those conflicts, chapter 30. All right, this morning, what I'm going to start with are some very interesting commentary. I mentioned this this book to you before, but remember, this is the only real exchange of sisters that we get in the Bible. And we've had brothers, but we don't have sisters. So this morning, I first of all turned to this book that I mentioned to you before, The Torah, A Woman's Commentary, which just won the National Jewish Book Award, Tamar Eshkenazi and Andrea Weiss, to see what they have to say about this incident, which is clearly an incident of interaction of women. I'm going to go through their commentary, and then if we have time, I'm going to tell you what Leon Cass has to say about it. Let's start with verse 3, okay? Rachel can't have children. So she says to Jacob, "Here's my maid Bilhah. Couple with her and let her give birth on my knees so that I too may have a son through her." All right? You with me? Now, this is what their commentary says. "By employing her slave Bilhah as a surrogate, Rachel performs a kind of imitative magic in which she plays God, causing a woman to conceive in the hope that the Creator will likewise fertilize her." Right? Imitative magic is when you do something in the hope that it will be done to you. So Rachel gets Bilhah pregnant in the hopes that God will get her pregnant. That's at least one of the possible interpretations here. All females on the narrative stage at the moment, in other words, everybody who's participating, Bilhah, Zilpah, Leah, Rachel, at the moment of birth, function as a collective body absorbed in the process and implication of birthing. That is, the midwives help take part in the naming of the child. So, for example, in Genesis, I'll read you the verse. You don't have to turn to it. In 35, 37, just in case you want to make a reference to it later. This is what I'm sorry, 35, 17 and 18. "When labor was at its hardest, the midwife said to her, 'Have no fear, it's another boy for you.' But as she breathed her last, for she was dying, she named it Ben-Oni, but her father named it Benjamin." That's Rachel's last birth, and the midwife is there. Then again at 38, 29, and I'll tell you why I'm reading all this in a second. "But just then he drew back his hand and came out," when she was in labor, rather, "when the time came to give birth, there were twins in her womb. One brings out his hand and then the other," and then also, I won't turn to Samuel. In other words, at least as far as they're concerned, all the women are implied in the process of giving birth. Remember, the midwives defy Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh that they can't help it, that the Jewish women give birth before they can stop them. That this is, and I think that you would find this only in a woman's commentary, probably a man wouldn't think of it this way, this is a collective female enterprise. That is, Leah and Rachel and the midwives, they're all involved in the process of giving birth to a child. And if you think about it, in a community, when a child is born, women come over, they're all participants in some way. It's not just Rachel who's giving birth, right? It's the whole house that's giving birth. When Leah gives birth, it's the whole house that's giving birth. And this is worth noting because when we read this, we just see it as Rachel and we just see it as Leah. But in reality, that's not how it works. I mean, if you watch, you know, old DVDs of like Little House on the Prairie or the Waltons, when a woman gives birth, all the women from the village come over to get hot water or whatever. I don't know what you use the hot water for, but everyone always has to have hot water when they give birth. So that's what they're saying here, is that this is, that Bilhah's giving birth is a collective giving birth. It's not just Bilhah, and we shouldn't just see it that way. Birth as a collective female action even transcends ethnic difference, as in the book of Ruth. There, Ruth the Moabite pledges to bind her body and her fate to her Israelite mother-in-law, Naomi, who declares herself too old to be married. Right? Ruth is basically giving birth for Naomi, because Naomi can't have children anymore, and her two sons die, remember. Naomi has two sons, they both die. That's why Ruth and Orpah are both free to go to Israel, and, well, Ruth does anyway, and remarry. Orpah goes back home to Moab. And the idea is Ruth is really having Naomi's surrogate child, which is why if you read the book of Ruth, Naomi is the one who makes everything happen. It's a very, very interesting. If you read the book of Ruth, which will take you, you know, no time, it's very short. It'll take you all of a half hour to read the whole book at most. If you read the book of Ruth and you think about who's causing all the action, it's remarkable how Naomi really makes everything, you know, Ruth is like, I don't want to say Ruth is a pawn because that makes it seem her seem too ineffective, but Ruth takes direction. Naomi is the older, wiser woman who makes everything happen. Okay. Viewed now, this the reason that they say all this is interesting, because she ends up her comment by saying, viewed from a more individualistic perspective, it's deeply problematic that the matriarchs potentially force their servants into undesired sexual relations. Right. In other words, if you think of this as not a collective enterprise but an individual enterprise, it's not so great that they make their maidservants have sex with their husband, which, you know, sort of goes without saying. But okay, now, then we get to the exchange between the sisters. And the exchange between the sisters, and I'm going to use the, they use a slightly changed translation. I don't know which translation they're using here. It may be a new one, but it's not the standard JPS one. I'm sure it says here somewhere. Anyway, so let's go to the section where Rachel and Leah have their exchange with each other and see what we can learn from the sisters. Okay, verse 9. When Leah saw that she'd stopped bearing, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a concubine. Okay, this is after Rachel gives Bilhah. Now, one of the things that I think Benno Jacob, who is a German rabbi, points out, he says, this was a greater humiliation for Leah than it is for Rachel. Rachel can't have children, so she gives her concubine. Leah's had children. She has that potential, but she stopped having children. Now, normally you would say, okay, so you have four kids. That's all right. But because she can't stand the thought, according to Jacob, that her husband's love is based on her children, and she stopped having children, and Rachel already has children, she feels forced to bring Zilpah into the mix. Maybe so. You're going to get a different perspective in a bit. When Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son, Leah said, what luck. She named him God. When Leah's maid Zilpah bore a second son, Leah said, what fortune. Women will deem me fortunate. She names him Asher. So now she's got four. Once at the time of the wheat harvest, Reuven came upon some mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. Now, mandrakes, as I said, for most commentators are fertility symbols. You know how mandrakes are shaped? They're shaped like men. They have two roots like this that come out, right? It looks like the trunk of a man, and therefore they were considered fertility symbols. Any of you who've ever seen any of the Harry Potter movies will remember how mandrakes are shaped. But if you haven't, then your kids aren't the right age. Okay, so they were considered fertility symbols, but Benno Jacob, again, says it might be considered just that they were desirable flowers or plants, and Reuven gave them to Leah to bring home to Jacob. right? Which kids will sometimes do. If you think your mother's not the more loved, so he gives her flowers and says, here, bring these home to daddy, right? He'll love you more. And by the way, while we're talking about this, one thing that Leon Cass brings in his book, which I've never heard of and never knew, but is fascinating, is, you know, the Chinese language doesn't work in letters. It works in pictograms, right? There are symbols for things. So you know what the symbol for trouble is? Two women in one house. Isn't that amazing? How about that? And China's a very old and wise civilization, as you know. But she said to her, wasn't it enough for you to take away my husband? You'd also take away my son's mandrakes, which, according to Jacob, is if she was going to bring these to, I mean, according to Benno Jacob, if she was going to bring these to Jacob as a, you know, nice offering, now Rachel wants to do that too. And by the way, it's ambiguous who took whose husband, of course, when she says you took my husband. You know, it depends who's, I mean, yeah, legally, yes, but romantically, she took Rachel's husband, really. When Jacob came home from the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you're to sleep with me, buddy, for I've hired you with my son's mandrakes. And he lay with her that night. This also has the potential, depending on how you want to dramatize it, to be very sad, because you wonder, how did Jacob lay with Leah that night? Reluctantly, mechanically, does he express any affection to her? I'm going to give you a different perspective in a minute, but it's at least possible. God heeded Leah, and she conceived and bore him a fifth son. And Leah said, God's given me my reward for having given my maid to my husband. So she named him Yisachar. When Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son, Leah said, God's given me a choice gift. This time my husband will exalt me, for I've borne him six sons. She named him Zvulun. Last she bore a daughter and named her Dinah. Now that's seven, by the way. That is seven, okay? Perfect number of children. Let's put Dinah aside for a moment. We will return to Dinah. In a strange way, Dinah becomes, except for Joseph, the one who has the only one who has a story, and Judah, who has a story specifically written about her, but it's a horrible story. It's the rape of Dinah, and we'll come to that. But for a second, let's think about the sons. Leah has six. Rachel gets two, right? Joseph and Benjamin. Zilpah has two. Bilhah has two. So returning again to Benno Jacob's commentary, he says, really the way it's supposed to work is if you add together the wives, they have eight and the concubines have four. So the wives are twice as important, you know, in theory. And really the way it should work is Leah gets four, Rachel gets four, Bilhah gets two, Zilpah has two. So why does Leah get six and Rachel gets two? He says this may in fact be the significance of the story with the mandrakes, that Leah gets two more sons that would have been Rachel's were it not for the mandrakes, which could be a parallel to Esav and the food in the field, right? Esav would have gotten the blessing, but he's hasty, he's impulsive, he asks for food from Jacob, so he doesn't get the blessing. Rachel might have gotten sons, but she wants the mandrakes. She gives up sleeping with Jacob for the mandrakes, so the two sons go to Leah. I don't know if it's true, but it's an interesting way of thinking about it. And because this is such a complicated emotional story, and there are so many different threads, as you will see in a moment, it's hard to say, no, that one couldn't be. So let's now go to the women's commentary and a couple of the ways that they read this, which I think is very interesting. Exchange between the sisters. The turning point in the sisters' relationship comes with their readiness to enter an exchange, to give each what the other lacks, okay? Symbolically, Leah is willing to give fertility via the mandrakes, they see them as a fertility symbol, to her barren sister. And in return, Rachel gives Jacob to Leah, who longs for love. Whereas Jacob will draw a truce with God and then negotiate a peace with his brother, Rachel strikes a deal with her sister and then wins the ability to create from God, right? Jacob first wrestles with the angel, makes peace with God, and then makes peace with his brother. Rachel, on the other hand, makes peace with her sister and then gets what she wants from God. They're drawing that parallel because there is some parallel between Jacob and Esau, obviously, and Rachel and Leah. Remember, the parallel goes back to the fact that Rachel is substituted. Leah becomes the person that Jacob's sleeping with when he thinks it's Rachel, and Jacob is the person that Isaac's blessing when he thinks it's Esau, right? That original substitution. Okay. Now, in verse 21, where it says, afterwards she bore a daughter and named her Dinah. Do you see that? That was the last verse we read. The phrase she conceived and she bore associated with the birth of each son is absent here. It doesn't say she conceived and she bore. Also absent is a naming declaration for Dinah, although her name means judgment that leads to justice. Well, or justice, right? So that's very interesting. Why doesn't it, it's almost like Dinah is, well, one way you can think of it is Dinah is completely natural, almost as if she's spontaneously generated, right? She doesn't have to conceive and bear. She just gives birth. And Dean means judgment. So there are lots of ways of seeing the judgment here. And we can actually, we'll see that in a second. And now the next verse says, God now remembered Rachel. God listened to her and opened her womb. She became pregnant and bore a son. She said, God has removed my disgrace. Therefore, she named him Joseph, saying, may God add another son for me. So first of all, once she has a son, now she wants more. Right now that she's had the experience of what it is to have a child, she's not satisfied to have one child because the experience obviously was important to her, even though that request will lead to her death because she dies in giving birth to Benjamin, right? This is their commentary again. The mandrakes do not cure Rachel's barrenness. They alert God to her desperation, which is very interesting because it's true. The first verse doesn't say God said she got mandrakes and gave birth. It says God saw what happened and took note of her, because God felt bad for her since she was barren. And then she conceives and gives birth. And the lengths to which she will go in order to conceive. It's not just that God takes note of her, but God says, look, she's even trying magical tricks to get me, so all right. You know, and I know this sounds strange to think that God does this, but this is how God works in the Bible, right? The Jews are in Egypt for hundreds of years. They cry out to God and God remembers them. So, in other words, there has to be an initiative from below to get the attention of above, right? This is the theory. This is the theory of prayer is, yes, I know that God knows what I want, but unless I show that I have a certain initiative, why should God pay attention to my desires? If they're not important enough to me to work for, to pray for, whatever, then why should they be to God? In other words, the action that Rachel takes to reverse her situation functions as a self-initiation to her relationship to God. This is how she learns to relate to God, is by taking this action, okay? They also prove her to be an ambitious mother worthy of a heroic son. That's a little, okay, a little rhetoric there. She's followed a three-part course in protesting her infertility, articulated her discontent, surrogacy, and medicinal aid. God responds with three actions. He remembers, God, actually they say God remembers, listens, and opens her womb. Acts of memory are the first step to redemption. And that's true, as you know, with God throughout the Bible. God remembers and then acts in one way. And again, you shouldn't take memory too literally. It's not like God forgot, had to leave himself a note, you know. But rather that God takes note. That might be a better way to put it, is that God took note of the situation rather than saying specifically, God remembers, celebrating her victory. Rachel already begins strategizing for another. Okay. Now, all of this, interestingly, we have always assumed all along the way that Rachel is the loved one and the Torah feels sorry for Leah. But a biblical scholar named Tammy Schneider writes another view, and she tries to make the case that, in fact, Leah is the favored one. And I thought, since we've been assuming the opposite, you really are far away today. I feel like I'm speaking to, I don't know why they set it up this way. I thought that it would be interesting to hear. For many, the love story between Rachel and Jacob shows the text preference for Rachel over Leah. If one reads the story through modern eyes where love conquers all, then Rachel seems to be more important. However, if you read this parsha with an eye towards biblical concerns, then it looks very different. I'm abbreviating a little bit. The Torah begins by noting that Rachel's beautiful of form and face. To modern readers, beauty is positive, but in the Hebrew Bible, it's dangerous. And it's dangerous for women. not just for men. It proves to be dangerous for Joseph, too. Remember, Joseph is beautiful. Potiphar's wife goes after him and lands him in jail. And then the Midrash says when he comes out and is told that he's loved, the Midrash has Joseph saying, please don't love me, because love has been dangerous for me. Remember, his father loves him and gives him the coat. His brothers, as a result, throw him in the pit. Potiphar's wife loves him, gets in jail. So being pretty is not an unmixed blessing. As we know from, it was really interesting, speaking of this. It's not an unmixed blessing, which you know from reading any tabloid, yes? But the other night, and I can repeat it because he said it publicly, about a month ago, we had the situation of Persian Jews in America, and Jimmy Delshad was there, and Gina Nahai, and Sam Nazarian, and I. And Sam Nazarian, as you know, runs clubs where, in order to get in, you're supposed to be young and beautiful, right? That's the criteria, or well-known. So they were talking about, he said, the most difficult position for a Persian Jew in America right now is to be a young, pretty woman, because it draws so much envy and gossip and backbiting, and because there's this tremendous competition for resources, essentially, for the same men who have the same status. He said, and I see it all the time. He said, and I see a lot of them who are living a very fast and high life have a very hard time with, you know, money and sex and drugs and all those things, all of which you have access to as a young, pretty woman in a way that you don't otherwise. So that is in sort of microcosm, because this is Beverly Hills, right? All you have to do is watch any of these shows that show young, attractive people in Beverly Hills. That is in microcosm exactly what she's saying, that biblically, the beauty was not always considered an unmixed blessing. And it's not for anybody who is old enough to evaluate it from outside of that circle, right? And to look in, which means usually old enough to have children. Abraham argues that Sarah's beauty threatens his life. Remember that? You're beautiful. The king's going to grab you. It's not going to be good. Think of predators, older men, younger women, right? Not a great thing. A colleague of mine, as long as I'm on the story track, a colleague of mine had the courage to say, I don't know that I'd have the courage to say such a thing, but it really was very powerful. He was talking to a bat mitzvah, and he was telling them how important it is to dress appropriately for your bat mitzvah. And she said that she wanted to wear a miniskirt. And he said, I don't want you to wear a miniskirt on your bat mitzvah. And she said, why? And he said, because you don't want men my age looking at you like that. Which, you know, was a little bit of a risky thing to say, but he said, made the point, and she got it. So, Sarah's beauty threatens his life. Amnon, remember, rapes Tamar, supposedly because of her beauty. In other places in the Bible, when people make choices because of what they see, the choices prove to be misguided. Lot chooses to live in the Jordan Plain because it looks nicer than Canaan and ends up in Sodom. Samson marries a Philistine woman because of his appearance and ends up hairless. And the results are disastrous. Clearly, the Bible does not recommend judging a book by its cover. The text notes that seeing Leah was disfavored, God opened her womb. This clearly means that God sympathized with Leah. Leah names her first child Reuven because of a play on words that God saw her plight, but adds what she hopes it will bring her, the love of her husband. The second child follows the same pattern. Shimon is so called because God heard of her plight. The third son, Levi, is named in the hope that her husband will be attached to her. All three names reflect not only thankfulness, but a need for more, namely Jacob's love. With her fourth son, something finally changes. We've noticed this before, remember? And she names him Judah because this time I give thanks to God. Now, we said that's because she's finally gotten over the thought that having more children is going to give her Jacob's love. But Professor Schneider says, thus Judah becomes the forefather of the Jewish people, his name because his mother is simply thankful to the deity to have him, and maybe that means she attained Jacob's love. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, we saw it as she's given up, but maybe she didn't give up. Maybe she accomplished. Not clear. Anyway, you could see this as the sign of God's favor is you have children. So she has children. And we've been feeling sorry for Leah, but maybe really Rachel is the one to feel sorry for. And you don't feel sorry for the young, pretty woman, which is another reason why it's more difficult, right? Because the idea that she would have a problem or have the tougher time is discounted because, after all, she's the beautiful one. So anyway, worth thinking about. It's a little bit like what someone said about being rich. And I don't remember who said it, but it was a brilliant comment. They said, the rich are less fortunate than the poor because the rich have lost the one last illusion that the poor have, which is that being rich will make you happy. Right? The poor still have that illusion, but the rich don't have it anymore. But you could say the same thing about being beautiful, which is that the beautiful have lost that illusion that those who are not beautiful have, which is that being beautiful will make you happy. And obviously, that's not true. It can. I mean, it's a power like any other power, right? There's powers of money, there's powers of intellect, there's powers of beauty, there are powers of connection, powers of family. All of them have the potential to do things, and also all of them have the potential to upend you. So that in and of itself shouldn't make us assume that Rachel is in great shape. In fact, I'll read you what Cass says about it. He has a sort of scathing line, but he's kind of puritanical. That's true. It seems as if the love of the beautiful is by itself sterile. You know, sterile means without children, but it also means empty. So he's saying that the love of the beautiful is sterile because he loves Rachel for her beauty and nothing comes of it. Whereas Leah, you got kids. All right. Before we take questions and comments, I have a bunch more stuff, but I want to read just one. Cass is a little bit down on Rachel, I must say. He says, you know, that having Joseph doesn't lead to fulfillment the way it does with Leah. It just leads to more desire, right? She wants more children. That's why she says, Yosef, give me additional children. But all right, this is what he says, though. And in reading this, I realized this is the difference between, again, the difference between men and women, which we've had much occasion to comment on. He's commenting now on the difference between the quarrel between brothers that we've seen often in the Torah and this only quarrel that we've seen between sisters. And I'm going to read you the whole paragraph. It's a little bit long, but though we're tracking the adventures of Jacob, it's worth noting that the tale just considered is the only story in Genesis about two sisters, except for the brief episode of Lot's daughters, but where they plot to have sex with their father. Remember that? That's the only other one. If the Cain and Abel story showed us the unvarnished, that means wasn't gussied up, it wasn't made nicer, about relations between brothers, perhaps this one does likewise for the relations between sisters. If so, the following comparisons seem to be suggested by the text. The brothers were rivals for preeminence, right? One wanted to be on top, not sexually speaking. It's very hard to speak, you know, when you're in, when you're already in that territory, it's very hard to use the English language in an unbiased way. So for preeminence, to be first in paternal or divine approval, to excel in worldly standing and success, to win renown and glory, right? That's what the brothers wanted. The sisters are rivals for love and creativity. Creativity meaning creation, right? To possess exclusively the love of a man, to be supreme as the mother of all living. Leah is a mother who wants to be beloved. Rachel is beloved, but wants to be a mother. Both brothers rage and fume, confront each other directly, and fight it out even to the death. Sisters smolder with envy and resentment, try to enlist men in their cause, Jacob for Rachel, Reuven for Leah. And if they fight, they fight with speech that wounds. Both brothers and sisters fight about what the modern reader might call their identity in the face of our inevitable mortality, the fact that we'll die, right? But different roles and attitudes towards procreation, towards childbirth, create different grounds for rivalry. In battling one another, men rebel against domesticity, the symbol of need for those who come after. Women fight for domestic supremacy and control over the procreative future. Men don't care about domesticity. They care about the world and let the kids take care of themselves, right? And women are fighting for control of what comes after them for the children. So I thought that was a great paragraph about the difference, first of all, about the difference the way the Bible shows it, but also about the realism in that depiction of the different ways that men and women fight, which you hear from kids on the schoolyard, right? That the boys will hit each other and the girls will say mean things about each other. and the girls will do it behind each other's back, and they're pass notes and all of that stuff, and the boys will just, you know, will just fight and try to win. Try to win, right? Not try to be in the inner circle. They'll try to win the game, because winning the game constitutes being in the inner circle. That's what it means to win the game. So very different ideas. Okay, let's stop there and take questions and comments. Yeah. That's a good question. The word in Hebrew, it doesn't say hired here. It just says, tomer elai tavo. You'll come, it does, sachar, I'm sorry, sachar, sachar ticha. Yeah. They translate it here as I have bought you, but which also schar is schar wages, but so hired is also a decent translation. I guess the idea is that he was owed to Rachel that night, or would have gone to Rachel that night. In some way, it was Rachel's right to have him, and Leah bought that right from Rachel. So she purchased a third party by paying Rachel. So yeah. Apparently not. Either she stopped bearing or she stopped sleeping with him, which is also possible. And that's, I mean, that's, if you want to interpret this as a sad story for Leah, that's the way that I would look at it, is she stopped sleeping with him and she had to hire him. She had to hire him from Rachel in order to get back into his bed. Yeah. Yes.
When Rachel, when God feels sorry for Rachel, so he gives her children. When something good happens, we say, thank you, God. But if disease and death happens and she dies in childbirth, mm-hmm. what do we say then? We make up another story.
It depends who we is. I mean, it depends biblically. Biblically, it was God's intention for her to die then. I mean, if you're asking modern theologians, there's a whole range of answers that would take us too much time to go into now, although the last Lunch and Learn was about why God permits evil, if you want to go back and go over the class, but in the Bible, it's clearly God's intention. Why that's God's intention, there's a nice midrash about it. In fact, there's not only is there a nice midrash about it, but if you want the full story, I'll do just tell it very quickly. It had a profound effect on the history of Israel. The midrash is that Rachel dies in childbirth on the side of the road. That's where Rachel's tomb is, so that when the Israelites go into exile, she can weep for them as they go by, and she can pray for them, because she's not in Israel. She was buried on the way. So the story is that Max Nordau, who became president of the Zionist Congress, was one of the most important Zionists in the early history of Zionism, late 1800s, early 1900s, was a renowned doctor, had no interest in Judaism or Zionism or anything, but he was a good guy, and he used to treat patients for free, and he once treated a little girl, a 10, 11-year-old girl, for free, and her father said, I have nothing to pay you with. And he said to the girl, instead of paying me, tell me a story, which is kind of a charming and sweet thing to do. And she told him the story of how Rachel died on the side of the road and therefore wept for the Israelites who were in exile. And he was so struck by the fact that, first of all, the story was preserved for thousands of years, and that this little 11 or 12-year-old girl was telling him the story, that he went to investigate the Zionist movement to help restore the Jewish people to their homeland. So,
what was the name of?
Max Nordau, N-O-R-D-A-U, and D-A-U, yes. Go ahead. And if you look, you can look him up in like Wikipedia or Google him. And if it doesn't have that story, I can find you the story. Yeah.
I'm not sure this is exactly on point, but when you were describing the difference between men and women, the masculine part, mm-hmm. the warrior type, the domestic type, I couldn't help but think how our stories would have been different had Esau gotten what was entitled to him. Esau was the man. What does that make Jacob?
A different kind of man. I mean, Rachel's one kind of woman. Leah's a different kind of woman.
Well, we can say that Jacob is much ambiguity than Jacob.
Although, don't forget, Jacob also lifts a very heavy stone. I mean, you know, he wrestles an angel. He's not a wuss. So we are not the wussy people. But no, I don't know. It's impossible to, well, I would say two things. First of all, it's impossible to know what would happen if Esau got the blessing entitled him. And second, if God intended for Esau not to get it, then Esau wasn't going to get it. It wasn't really intended to him. That may have been Isaac's intention, but it wasn't God's. So, yeah.
A friend of mine asked me when Jacob received the name of Israel, the rest of the story never mentions
it. It goes back and forth, right.
It's always mostly Jacob.
Yeah, mostly Jacob, though not entirely. There's a lot of discussion about that. I would just say that he doesn't lose his Jacobness. He doesn't become subsumed in Israel. He still remains... He remains both an individual and the what's called eponymous, that is, his name becomes a general term for things. He also becomes the eponymous head of the people, but he doesn't only become the head of a people, it's true. So you go back and forth, even in the Amidah, we say Elohei Avraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov. We don't say Elohei Yisrael, right? So, yeah.
It seems that in a very subtle way, in the Bible, in this section, women are really strong in orchestrating everything. For example, the maids were given to Jacob by the children.
Right.
Or Rachel decides that tonight we go to Leah.
Yes.
Jacob seems like a dog, just, you know, going with the women.
Yep. Well, so the interesting question here is, how did women lose that status? In the Bible, you're right, it's clear that women don't have a public status the way men do, but they're much more influential and important than they are, for example, in the Talmud. In the Talmud, there are two women mentioned, and only one of them really has teachings in her name. I'm talking about as Israelite, as possible sages or so on. And this is, I'll tell you... There's at least one interesting theory that I know of as to why that's true, which was written by a rabbi named Friedman a while back. I don't know if scholars still accept this, but he blames it on Rome. He says in the Roman world, the status of women, even though there were women who broke out of it, the status of women was much lower than it was in the ancient Near Eastern world. And because the Talmud was written in Rome, the rabbis used the same social standards as the surrounding society. But it's very sad to see the decline, because the women in the Bible are fascinating and strong characters, but as you move on to Talmudic tradition, their voices grow softer and softer. Yeah.
Right. But obviously they are women.
Yes. So. Right. I wouldn't say that women's influence has declined. That's why I said their voice has. Because their influence is just as great, except that their voices are only heard through men. So who knows how many teachings that we know in the name of rabbis were in fact teachings from their mothers. And I'll give you an example. Rare because it's recent. From the traditional world, Baruch Epstein, who was the writer of the Torah Tamima, one of the great commentators of the 19th century, had his mother's sister, who was apparently a brilliant woman, and he writes about her in his autobiography and how bitter she was that she wasn't allowed to study. And he writes that she had a tremendous mind and would have been a great scholar, but she wasn't allowed to study. Now, even that is more than we know of earlier. But you get this, and in the 19th century is when people start to notice, except for some very scattered women here and there, when people start to notice the waste of, Emerson says the same thing. He writes about his aunt, Mary Moody Emerson, who was the great intellectual influence in his early life. But we don't know anything about her except a couple of things that Emerson writes about her, because, I gave a drash on Mary Moody Emerson, because she said something that made clear to me something about the Passover story I never understood, which is why matzah is the symbol for the Passover story. Why, of all things, matzah? So they didn't have time to bake bread. I mean, there are better symbols for slavery than not having to bake bread. But she once said to Emerson, this is one of the things that he quotes in his journals, "Hurry is for slaves," which is a great line. That slave, part of being a slave is not being able to control your time. And if you can't control your time at all, you're a slave. So she said that to him. She also once said to him, "Always do that which you are afraid to do." So she was a very important influence for him. Now, who knows what she would have been had she had Emerson's opportunities. So anyway, yeah. That's the lesson. Who told you you're going to be happy? What's the matter with you? Right. Yeah. What's the lesson in the story? It's a great question. So I would let's take a couple of stabs at it. The first thing I would say is the lesson of the story might be that Chinese ideogram, which is the lesson for trouble is two women in the same house. Here's actually a lesson that twists that to a good thing. Rivalry and even envy can be creative. You wouldn't have gotten those children were the sisters not competing with each other, right? But it's not going to be easy and it's not going to be painless. And the idea that family life will be easy or painless is an idea that can only exist in artificial environments, but not in real families.
Have the rabbis used this story in order to argue for monogamy?
I don't know if there's a rabbinic argument for monogamy, particularly. There was a takana, but I don't remember a particular argument for monogamy. I think it was just assumed, although if they did, I don't think that they would do that because, in part, you don't want to use Jacob as a counter argument. I mean, maybe a modern rabbi would, but I don't think classically someone would. Yeah. What's that? Moody. Mary Emerson Moody. Moody. Yes. And
the lesson would be that you're responsible for your own happiness, not your husband, not your children.
Right.
They don't learn that lesson.
Yes.
But I don't know who learns it.
Right. That you're responsible for your own happiness. Yeah. One, two, three. Okay.
Is there much written about Jacob's sons? Many of them are the same age, or probably close to the same age. What do we know about the sons?
Well, you'll see as we go along. There's some. Shimon and Levi take revenge for Dinah. Judah has some incidents with Tamar. They all throw Joseph into the pit. So, again, rivalries. The Genesis is a series of tales about difficulties in families. No doubt about it. So, yeah.
One has a crazy question. Is it that God writes the screenplays for the two wives and the 12 children and the 12 tribes of Israel, Joseph going to Egypt, the great,
yes,
the flourishing of Jews from Egypt and so forth? Is it that he writes this and then these things happen? Or is it that these things happen?
Yeah, it's not a crazy question at all. It is not a crazy question at all. The reconciling God's design and human free will is a very difficult enterprise. In fact, again, this is what we talked about at the last lunch, this past Lunch and Learn. All I would say is there's no entirely satisfactory answer to that. We could talk about it a lot, but the bottom line is there's no entirely satisfactory answer for how God could want certain things to come out and still give people choices. Let's leave it there for the moment. It's a much longer discussion, but I don't know that anybody's come up with a design that suits the way human beings can conceive of it. So, yeah.
Well, I was struggling with the question that Owen asked earlier about how Jacob was the man, not with the sword as symbolic, but with certainly words. He's the biblical word guy. And when you describe women as not having words themselves, they were behind Emerson, behind the words, I was just moved very much by this whole historical procession where you have a Torah.
Right.
The first time that is the commentary written by women. So women haven't left the domesticity to pick up the sword in quite the same way as men have, but
Oh, well, there's no doubt about that. That's well, this is part of all the modern female reclamation of not just the Jewish tradition, but I mean, Judith Plaskow's book on Jewish feminist theology is called Standing Again at Sinai. And that just that tells you the, you know, it's like all those voices that we didn't get to bring forward, we do now. So it's certainly true that it not, and it's not only the case that you find out that these teachings that you otherwise would not have known, or not rather would only know through men, but also all these voices that otherwise were just lost. So the only way that we know, for the most part, with the exception, for example, of Gluckel of Hamelin, who is a notable exception, who wrote a journal in the Middle Ages, in the 16th century in Poland, that we still have, which is a very rare thing, testimony of a woman in the Middle Ages. But apart from that, essentially the only way we know about the effect of women is from the testimony of men. There are some, for those of you who are interested, there are some exceptions. There's a book called Four Centuries of Jewish Women's Spirituality. It was just reissued in a revised edition that collects and anthologizes writings from women over the centuries, but it's very heavily weighted towards the modern period because there just isn't that much. We have Hannah's Prayer in the Bible and Deborah's Song. There is some stuff, but come the Middle Ages, the voices go mute, and we don't have what the Christian tradition has. That is, we don't have nunneries where women sit and write spiritual testimonies because they live in a community of women, since the Jewish tradition didn't have monasteries or nunneries where people were sequestered on mountaintops. So Saint Teresa of Avila could write her spiritual testimony, and by the way, she had Jewish ancestry, just want to point that out, and quite beautiful and moving spiritual testimony, but had her family stayed Jewish, we would never know of her, paradoxically, because, you know, we know that there were some women mystics, but we don't have any of their writings. It's a sad thing. So, yes, Don. Yeah.
Well, you know, if we get a change from the handmaiden, I'm not sure how to express the question, but there seems to be mixed blood here, or the genealogy comes from Jacob. From the men's side, you now get...
Right. Well, I'll say two quick things. First of all, according to Rashi, because Rashi doesn't like this kind of thing, he says that Bilhah and Zilpah were actually Lavan's children with another wife, so it's all in the family. But the change to matriarchal descent is much later, right? In the Bible, it's patriarchal descent, by and large. I mean, by and large, I don't want to say exclusively, because obviously it's Sarah who carries Isaac, and Abraham has other children, but they're irrelevant to the story. But by and large, it follows the tribal model, which is the male model, as opposed to the matriarchal model. The matriarchal model really seems to have come into being in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, which is at the end of the biblical period, but not before. There's a lot of scholarship about this. His name used to be at the seminary. I can picture his face. Shai Cohen has written a book actually about this exact issue. Yes, last two questions, 1-2. Right.
Because they don't count the
yes.
Because
nope.
They
weren't married. They're maid servants. Exactly. So. Nope. They don't make it because they weren't married to Jacob. Because they were considered surrogates. They're considered really their children are Rachel's children or Leah's children. That's the way it worked in the ancient world. They didn't have status. Yeah. Right.
That in her sense of self and her self-delineation came from the fact that she had four children and she felt
right. That was our assumption. Our assumption in the first time we went over it, not today but last time, was that she had gotten past it. That she realized that having children wasn't going to give wasn't going to give her his love. And so, a modern reading would be that she found it in herself. A biblical reading would be that she found it in God. But one way, or maybe they're the same thing. Okay, see you next week. Sione Zevit next week.